What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Mark Karras. So Mark reached out about his book called Religious Refugees, and I knew I had to have him on the show because Religious Refugees talks about a season, stations of life that are very difficult to navigate, which is somebody going through questioning their faith, what Mark calls a deconstruction, reconstruction process. And so I think with people in my life that I've been around, times in my life where I've sort of questioned things, it's a hard process to walk with somebody through, and it's a hard process to go through. And so Mark kind of breaks down this process and helps normalize some things, help talk about some of the, you know, trauma maybe around the church and how some of that happens. And so we get into it in this episode with just talking about how, what it looks like to sort of deconstruct and then reconstruct your faith, how that happens, what that looks like, and how we can be with people, walk alongside people going through similar processes. So at the beginning, Mark talks about his profession as a therapist, and it's cool how Mark's life just kind of leads him down this road, and he gets very real about his past and some of the things that happened with his family. There's a lot of stuff there, and I think you're just going to really appreciate his transparency. Also, Mark is a man of deep grace, and that comes out in this interview, and I think that all translates to coming out to God's gifting Mark to do what he does today. And I think that's really cool. You're going to get a lot out of it. I can't wait for you to hear it. Just a reminder to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford. I also have a new project out called Bootleg Bible College, which is about just the stuff that I think most Christians should know about the Bible, and there's no real place to find them out. So we're in a series on the Hebrew Bible, how that formed, where that comes from, how do we have the Hebrew text we have today. So you can find that on my socials, on my website. I encourage you to go check that out if that's something that interests you. We try to get very nerdy over there at Bootleg Bible College. So check all that stuff out for me, and I hope you enjoy hearing from Mark. All right, Mark. Well, thanks. I can't say thanks enough for joining me on the podcast. It's super fun to chat. Enjoyed the book and all the stuff you got going.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Curry, and looking forward to digging in the conversation here.
Awesome. Well, let's just maybe start off by just having you introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Well, I guess I could just start off with, I'm a guy who loves God and people.
That's perfect.
a husband, father of an incredible three-year-old. Very interesting, sensitive temperament. Definitely concerned about that. I know what the world does to us sensitive, creative folks.
Indeed.
But we need that too in the world. So,
yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. That's good. So for your vocation, you're a therapist, right?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Can we just maybe go down the path a little bit of like how
sure.
you became a therapist and like the maybe some of the why behind all that? I know that can be a big story, you know.
Yeah, it's a big lifetime drama filled with all kinds of drama worthy events. But the short story is, which I don't know if I could do it short, but I'm a licensed therapist, and I'm also an adjunct professor in a counseling program in a Christian university. So my story is really the foundation of why I became a therapist and who I am today. And so a part of that story, you know, I jest as a lifetime drama, but it is filled with drugs and violence and, you know, death and mental illness. It's pretty out there. And as somebody who, you know, we call it like a genogram, where you kind of trace family patterns and stuff of that nature throughout the generations. My great grandmother died in a mental hospital. Mm. Her sister was mentally ill. My father has a mental illness. Three out of his four brothers have a mental illness. My brother has paranoid schizophrenia, which in turn that ultimately through many events led him into prison. Mm. And while off his meds and through a very unfortunate circumstance, he murdered his cellmate off his medication, and he'll be in prison for the rest of his life. And then, so growing up in a milieu of dysfunction and death, and mother was a drug addict and she died from a drug overdose, and father was in the Pagans or motorcycle gang. And he actually just got out of prison. He was in there for probably 17, 18 years.
Wow.
So abuse, you know, all kinds of very difficult things. So I have a twin brother. I'm 2 minutes older than him.
Okay.
And then I'm a year and a half older than my younger brother. And I always, I fulfill that older brother role. Mm. And I think that's kind of gave me this sense of needing to be strong, wanting to heal, wanting to change, wanting to learn, wanting to be the protector. And so no wonder why I'm a therapist today. I will say, if it wasn't for going to school to be a therapist and at the same time a three-year degree in MDiv, and I'm just finishing up my doctorate, I would probably be in prison either killing myself or being a crazy narcissistic cult leader who led many to their demise.
Yeah.
So all that education and therapy and groups, man, I can't praise that environment's enough to, you know, to who I am today. So I'm very grateful for that. But that's a little bit of my story that propelled me into my profession. And then, you know, if it wasn't for, and there's a crazy wild testimony, you know, me wanting to, I was a cutter, depressed, lost, suicidal. I tried to get AIDS. And then it was probably a few weeks later, I remember being alone in this field, and I remember sticking my hands up and surrendering. And I said, God, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Literally the last phrase, like the BC moment. And I said, if you're real, show yourself to me. And I am a master deconstructor, and I tried to deconstruct that experience.
Yeah.
But I can't deconstruct the fact that nothing that I did in that moment, I didn't muster anything up. There was no fog machine. There was no crowd. There was no music. I was overwhelmed with a transcendent love that changed the trajectory of my life forever. Wow. And so that's, hence I'm still a Christian, regardless of the institution, the toxicity that can happen, not in every church, but certainly there's enough evidence that has hurt a lot of people, including myself. So yeah, that's a little snapshot, right?
Dude, that's some heavy stuff, Mark. I got to be honest. Like I knew sort of the, you know, the outlines of the story just going in because of the book. And I appreciated how you weaved that story into your writing. You know, I think that's really helpful for like understanding just where you're even coming from and like why, you know, the why behind not only your vocation, but like why you're writing. And a lot of helpful context there, I think, you know.
And the one last piece, I think, that fostered a deconstructive mind was getting saved in a Oneness Pentecostal church.
Right.
They were the only ones who were saved. Women couldn't trim their hair. They would go to hell. Men couldn't have facial hair. I wasn't allowed to hang out with people who believe in the Trinity. And so eventually getting out of that and realizing someone who's deceived doesn't know they're deceived. Man, I started asking all kinds of questions after getting out of that, and a few panic attacks to boot. But
yeah. Well, because, and I found this interesting, and maybe we'll start down this road. You know, not only did you experience abuse in your upbringing, you know, I think you would say, but I think you experienced profound abuse in your church, especially in the formative years of you first becoming a Christian, right? Through that early church experience. And like that amount of trauma, it can just really mess with you. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard stuff.
Messing with you, right? That's putting it lightly.
Yeah. Sorry.
I hear you. You know, I think of it, you know, coming from one hell into another. But I must say, and I think this is where spiritual and emotional maturity can come into play, I can look back and say there were some good experiences there. There were some welcoming, loving, affirming voices. And at the same time, right? So one of the tendencies that happens after trauma where we've been really hurt is the defense mechanism of splitting. And so we can split people or situations all bad or all good. Typically, we split people all bad so we can feel a little bit better right. about ourselves. Yeah. But there's so much complexity around this. I just wanted to share that partly as a therapist, but partly because I see that as one dynamic among many that occurs when people are really hurt by the church and are in this phase, if you will, or station where they just this angst fill where there are splitting and so much anger and cynicism and skepticism, which is normal and it really is healthy. You know, staying there is another question, you know,
right.
But it's part of the grieving process.
Yeah, for sure. I really appreciate you bringing that up. I feel like we in general don't do well in any sort of middle space, like holding two competing sort of emotions about the same, like even time experience or people, like you said, we're just not good at doing that. Like it does take a lot of maturity and it takes a lot of courage maybe to exist in those two places at the same time.
Yeah, it does. And can I share another defense mechanism that's common?
Please,
since I didn't know we would go on this topic, but just for a minute, because it's so seldom talked about. Now, for your listeners, my book is about helping those who are deconstructing and reconstructing their faith, or going through a faith shift, if you will, helping them know what's happening with them, healing, recovering, reconstructing, grieving well. But one of the defenses that's rarely talked about is the defense of displacement. And there was a season I was still actually 1 foot in the church in some ways, but I was so angry at the pastors and churches and these doctrines. And I remember visiting churches, you know, just because going with friends. And I was kind of a jerk. I would literally just curse to get a reaction, and it was kind of fun, but to see their faces, you know, but I know I was hurting inside. But I came to a realization that part of my hurt was, yes, it was the church, but also I was displacing, I was putting my trauma because of my previous trauma. In other words, I projected everything on the church as if they were the sole problem of my pain and my existential pain.
Right.
But really, I was deeply hurt and filled with so much shame before I even stepped in a church. Mm. Right? So it's easy to displace everything on the church, but sometimes it's helpful in the process of healing and integration of what was I bringing in already? Yes, I can be angry at what happened in the church, and what was happening even before that. So it's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I mean, I'm sure as a therapist, like those are the sorts of things you're looking for. Like, okay, so you're putting all this on, you know, this person or this institution or whatever, you know, how might previous things that have been going on be leading to some of these feelings that you're feeling right now, these emotions that you're having towards this one thing, right?
It's a warranted conversation. I see it all the time in couples work. You know, let's say if you're a spouse, let's say if you're a female partner and your husband is just kind of distant, or he's, you know, out in the garage, or he just kind of, you try to bring something up and he kind of stonewalls you and walks away. Yes, that's hurtful, but it's also triggering a early trauma and childhood wound of, oh my goodness, my father actually either A, abandoned me, or B, he never spent time with me and affirmed the beauty of who I was, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's just that conversation of we do bring a lot of stuff from the past to the present.
Yeah. How have you seen, I mean, just as you've seen clients now, how have you seen your past sort of preparing you for the work that you do today in the counseling room,
room. Yeah. I think it's very, you know, there's a passage, I think it's in Corinthians, and you can help me if I get this wrong, but you know, God comforts us, right? And with the same comfort that we have received, where this is invitation to then extend that same comfort, that same healing, if you will, to other folks, you know, the hotter the fire, the purer the metal, some say.
Yeah.
And those who have gone through, you can become bitter or you can become better. Mm. And through the grace of God, through some mentors and good people in my life, hopefully I'm continually getting better. But yeah, so there's a sense of, you know, whom loves much, who's forgiven much, loves much, right?
Right.
And so with so much healing and love and experience of grace, just I feel this, it's a call. It's in my bones to help others on the journey. Now, is that some of that older brother in there, right? Who sure. so wanted to be there for my younger brothers. I think just a inner call to walk alongside hurting folks, helping them reach their full potential in love in God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you say, and I'm just kind of tossing this out there as a, for instance, would you say that you're very rarely surprised by almost anything that somebody says or has gone through? I mean,
right. I know there's so many wild stories. Yeah. I mean, there's just, it's pretty rare to be completely shocked.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I've heard, you know, you get to the point where God, humanity, we're such a creative bunch when it comes to trying to mask our pain or to deal with our pain.
Right.
But there's still things like just really, you know, I don't need to get into details,
but it's
It's still, it's just, we're so freaking creative.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I just imagine like you've, you know, you've seen a lot as a, like growing up, and I would imagine it's, you know, people think that they are shocking with, you know, their creativity. And I would imagine they're not as shocking as you, they would think that they are.
Yeah. And I think that helps because one of the most curative or healing factors when it comes to working with people, and I, this is something that I hope to embody, is a compassionate, loving presence in the midst of the storm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so coming from a traumatic background, and then because those who have gone through trauma are always like, can you handle this? If I share this, well, are you going to be shocked? Are you going to be judgmental,
right,
critical? And when they still experience a loving presence, a loving calm presence in the midst of their trauma or pain or shocking, whatever, interior of their psyche, it's very healing. It's healing for me as I encounter that with people where they're like, I can give them anything. And they're with me. There's no judgment. There's no shock. There's no like, oh, how could you? Oh, you're supposed to be a Christian. I've gotten plenty of that. But they're not the healing folks that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. No, I think that's awesome. What role does sort of trauma and, you know, like counseling people through trauma play out in sort of your, you know, your work?
Well, yeah. I mean, so there's so many different kinds of traumatic experiences that people have. To be specific, now in this book, I'm, you know, dealing with people who have been hurt by the church.
Right.
And so there are some people who've been hurt and who have been traumatized, but they don't experience PTSD. Hmm. There are some that have been hurt and that have been traumatized and that have PTSD symptoms.
Right.
And so this, man, anyone who wants to take this seriously, and even if pastors, like my invitation to pastors is, listen, there's a group of people who sociologists are calling the de-churched, some ex-evangelicals. These people, if you want to be serious about mission, get to know these people.
Right.
Hear their stories. Hear the utter, for some, the utter a PTSD symptom, the insomnia, the hypervigilance, the panic attacks, right? The, you know, the utter sheer terror that some people experience, just the thought of, like some people say, I don't believe in hell. I haven't believed in a God who eternally torments us for 10 years. Yet just last night, I woke up and, you know, with sweats and I'm like, Mark, what's that all about? You know, that's what I call phantom theologies, like a phantom limb, where, you know, you might not have them, but they, you know, there can be experiences where you feel like they're still there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I feel like a lot of Christians don't come across people who have experienced trauma in the church, because normally somebody experiences a traumatic, something traumatic within the church and then just sort of disappears. Right. Like, There's no one to like reach out and maybe, you know, find out what's going on. You know, it's, it can be easy to sort of just drift away, especially as a, if you're not in like community and all of that stuff. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, there's very good reasons through the qualitative research, meaning researchers have looked and spoken with these people, qualitative, it's hearing their stories, and they've come through various themes that these are the reasons why some people are leaving the church.
Right.
And, you know, we need to take these things seriously as those who love the church and those who are pastors. And the problem is that it's easy to get into a mindset of they're heretics, they're apostates, they've been listening to the wrong podcasts, they haven't been reading the Bible, they haven't been praying enough, they're hanging out with Joe and Mary when they shouldn't, right? They're just basically, you know, how they're listening to Satan, right? Has God really, they're hanging out with people who question the word of God. It's their fault. Bye-bye. We have to just, you know, wipe our, the dust off our feet. But is that the proper attitude? Could there be things to learn as pastors from the research? For example, one of the things, the themes that come out in the research is politics and bureaucracy, right? In the face of church politics and bureaucracy, for example, some have a lot of gifts to share in the church, but because maybe they're divorced or too young or too old or not attractive enough or not articulate enough or not white enough or not abled enough or not educated enough, you name it, there's this, and sometimes it's implicit, sometimes it's explicit, you can only go up here in the church, right?
Right.
Forget about leadership. Forget about even serving or starting a ministry. And so when people experience those politics and bureaucracy, they're like, they feel disillusioned and they say, this is not where I want to be. Another is Clone War syndrome, where there's a sense that, you know, there's a, and this was true in my Pentecostal experience, where the church, there was a lot of fear and they felt like they were at war with culture, at war with the churches down the street.
Right.
So diversity was feared and stifled for the comfort of homogeneity. So there's no room for messy dialogue or discussion or, whoa, that no, don't even ask about that kind of theology. And that's, there's so many, and this is what the research shows, those who are leaving the church, and I quote, this is through Josh Packard's work, they were the most committed people in the church. These passionate, creative folks, outside of the box thinkers who wanted to be the literal hands and feet of God in the world, but who felt stifled by third grade Sunday school lessons, by boxed in kind of theologies and practices and policies. And they became disillusioned and said, I'm still in the church. I still love Jesus, but I'm having a big problem with this institutional stuff. And that breaks my heart. And I hope it breaks the heart of pastors to take a missional mindset to some of these folks who are legitimately hurting in some ways. And those are just a few of the themes.
Yeah. There's a lot there, a lot of hurt by the church. Yeah, for sure. Can you talk about, cause the book is all about this, sort of process of DR, deconstructionist and then reconstructionist, right? Can you sort of talk through what like a DR, you know, process even is, for people that may not be acquainted with that?
Yeah. There's a lot of people who experience a profound faith shift. They might not use the words deconstruction or reconstruction because they're a little, I mean, deconstruction, we're talking about Derrida, we're talking about it's coming from a deep philosophical kind of stream, if you will. So not everyone's familiar with that, but the experience could be reminiscent, regardless of the label. I call it sort of this religious disorientation growth syndrome. And so let me share a few symptoms, and regardless of the label we put on this, let's see if some listeners can resonate with some of this, right? So these are some of the symptoms of what I call religious disorientation growth syndrome, doubting or denying one's religious beliefs that were once held as true, a subtle or intense anxiety about a person's relationship with God, increase of painful emotions such as anger and loneliness, shame, guilt, sadness, and despair, isolation and criticism within from members within their own family, sometimes certainly within their own religious community, and this existential angst, if you will, about a person's identity and future self. Like when you kind of distance yourself a little bit of what you've been taught your whole life, it can be this really existential, like, oh my goodness, who am I? Right. Who am I in the world? Who is God? Who's the church? But I also say this can, I put growth in there because many people, if they do this well, and if they do this in community, that they can experience profound growth and transformation. So regardless of the label we want to put on it, it's this season or experience. Some people say, oh, well, you know, deconstruction, is you do that for a lifetime. I agree. And throughout our life, we might change a belief here or there. But I'm talking about a season in one's life that's so palpable that it changes things. It's like walking on a waterbed rather than solid ground. And this is the season I'm talking about. And of course, people might change a belief here and there and are fluid. Some, you know, as a therapist, I know some people can go to their graves not changing that much in their lives.
Right.
But yeah, this process and this experience is held by many. And that's why a lot of people are resonating with this book.
How would you compare what you're talking about there with maybe some of the like historical, like St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul? Like, would that be a similar thing? Would you say it would be or the same thing or yeah?
Yeah. Some people want to give a little distance between the Dark Night of the Soul because one little slight difference is with this deconstruction or reconstruction process, there are many folks who are not necessarily, they can go a different direction rather than being in an intimate relationship with God.
Okay.
Now, that's not what I desire. You know, I love God. And so it doesn't always lead there. The Dark Night of the Soul is usually a very specific experience that those who are deeply passionate about God and want to experience this almost mystical experience are like, God, where are you? Right? This is profound. And so the similarities, but typically that Dark Night of the Soul can lead to extreme spiritual transformation. Mm. And that's usually where it winds up going.
Right.
Not always the case in the deconstruction, reconstruction process.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. What I loved about you talking about the process of deconstruction and reconstruction is that it's not linear, right? Mm-hmm. That there's like these different, do you call them stations? I'm trying to remember off the top of my
head. Yeah, yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought that was a really helpful sort of analogy because I feel like sometimes it's easy to box in like what a process should look like. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I went with stations as opposed to stages because partly I'm a rebel because everyone's talking about stages, but partly because I'm always having a heart for the marginalized. Mm. And I feel like sometimes stages is so linear and it becomes so hierarchical where if you're at like this top stage, then, you know, the rest is sort of, well, you're not evolved in some way. Stations, it offers for me a slightly more compassionate lens in which to look at the different experiences that people have. And that's another difference is stages tend to box people in.
Right.
Whereas stations, this could be where you're at. You could be at stations that I'm not even articulating. And I don't want to give a 5-stage process where you absolutely need to fit in one stage or another. So this whole station approach, you know, sort of like, you know, you're traveling, you know, on a train and, well, here's this stop. Oh, I'm at this. Now I'm going back, right?
Right.
And I have names for each one of these stations and, you know, it'd take a little time to go through that. We could do that. But so I you know, have this eight stations that are pretty typical that I've seen that people go through in this process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think I found that to be helpful. And just even, you know, do you mind just talking about maybe some of them or?
Sure.
Whatever you.
I could give a quick snapshot.
Sure, yeah, that's
right? So one is sort of station one, you're feeling at home. This is a time where, you know, things are comfortable. You know, it's like going at home and, you know, you know what you're going to expect when you walk in the door at your own literal home, right? You see the pictures and you know where things are. And it's sort of like the sense when you're going to church, that's my church family, you know, there's going to be the, you know, the announcements and, you know, a little talk about what's going on in the church, some music and sermon. So very comfortable. Then the station two is like splinterhood. And I talk about, I have a whole chapter on splinters, but it's this experience where there's these conscious or unconscious thoughts, if you will, that kind of like, oh, what is that? That's like this cognitive dissonance. Mm. Like, this is what I've been taught for so long in the church, but this is something very different. And I'm struggling because I'm not sure what to believe. Right. So there's this tension, right? And so people can chill there for a little bit, not knowing exactly what's going on, but not, there's some cognitive dissonance. Station three is sort of this to be or not to be, I call, where there's this cognitive dissonance that's like a woodpecker just constantly nagging at you. And we have to ask ourselves, do I want to entertain this thought further, or do I want to just go back home? That's kind of the simplistic way of talking about it. Of course, right. I flesh all this out, right? Am I going to go back home and kind of to be the good Christian and stay within my church's boundaries of what's considered, orthodox beliefs and practices? Or, do I want to go somewhere else with this? Do I want to follow where this splinter is leading? Station four is returning home. It's saying, you know, I'm going to go back. And you turn, you know, you might go home a little different. Some people might be a little stronger in their faith because maybe they looked at sort of some of Brian McLaren's work or Mark Karras's work or Peter Enns' work, or, and they say, you know what, that's not true. I'm sticking with my John MacArthur and conservative beliefs or whatever it is, right? But then for some, they say, you know what, they go to station five where there's literal disorientation. I cannot ignore this cognitive dissonance anymore. And my whole faith, there's a profound shift. And there's this inner experience where there could be confusion and loneliness and for some despair because they don't feel like they can share it. But it's this experience of profound emotional pain where the monsters, if you will, of anxiety and fear, shame, anger, panic attacks, sleepless nights, nightmares, rejection, etc., are crawling all around. If you move to the next station, that could be sort of angstville. And I mentioned that where people are angry, people are cynical. How could I believe that? How could the church, how could the pastor say that? How could this church vote and support for this person?
Right, right.
God, Christians are this way. And they could chill there for a little bit. Station seven is some say, you know what? Farewell and goodbye. I'm going to move away from the Christian tradition. And some can be what they consider atheists or agnostics. Some people can be like F you Christians, or some can be, you know what, I'm moving on in a different stage of my life. And that was my background. That's a little bit of my past. And I don't wish anyone harm, but my journey is going somewhere else. And then finally, some people, instead of moving to station seven, go to station eight, which is extreme makeover home edition, if you will. And that is, wow, I feel not that I know all things, but I'm comfortable not knowing. I'm comfortable in mystery. I'm comfortable looking at Jesus as the primary hermeneutical lens in which I see God now. I don't worship the Bible. I see the Bible as pointing to Christ. And it's just this a little bit more acceptance of other traditions, maybe, but it's definitely a different place. But yet, while they may not be in the organized institutional religion, they're definitely a part of the church. They would say that they are. Some might have, you know, well, I'm not sure I would call myself a Christian. It's such a loaded term. Some do, but some might say, you know, I'm a follower of Jesus or I'm a follower of the way. You know, they don't want to distance themselves to people who have already have such a bad taste in their mouth when it comes to traditional understanding of Christianity. That's a snapshot.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. It's a good snapshot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, man, that process can be terrifying though, right? I mean, like, mm-hmm. it is a tough process to walk through, and not that I've walked through all of that or, you know, like even know exactly yeah. which station, you know, at this time, but like it can be terrifying to take that journey, I guess, right?
Well, listen, I mean, think about, you're a pastor. My heart aches for the many pastors that message me privately that have to, because if their churches knew the cognitive dissonance they were experiencing,
right.
the emotional pain they were experiencing, the differing of views that are emerging within them. And so then take it to more complications where, Mark, this is all I know.
Right.
Mark, this is how I'm supporting my family. And many people stay there in that place where they're trying to love the church as best as they can. But there's a hidden suffering. I've seen it way too much. It breaks my heart. And so then for some pastors, it's so painful that they just don't want to go there.
Right.
They'd rather sit in that station where they could be at church and have some cognitive dissonance, but they pushed a splinter down like a beach ball. But like most beach balls in the water, if you push it down, it inevitably will pop back up.
Right. And higher closely. And higher than, you know, pop way up. Right. And cause. Some, yeah. 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 I mean, mm-hmm. institutional church is hard for the people who attend church. Certainly. I think it can be even harder on the people who are in that system. You know what I mean? And making money because of that system. And, you know, there's a lot more on the line, I guess. Right.
Yeah, there really is. I have nothing but compassion for people in that place. And then, you know, there's another element that comes up. Well, if I come out and say I'm struggling with some of the things I used to believe, what's that going to do to my family? Right. Not monetarily, but spiritually.
Right, right.
Like, I don't want to mess with my wife's spirituality. Mm. I don't want to cause my kids to have distance with God. And so it's a profound existential, spiritual, emotional crisis for some. And yeah, I talk to these people and I love these people. And you know, if you're a listener who's one of them, you're not alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a great message. And I think that's important stuff to be talking about. What do you think is one of the biggest mistakes most people make when sort of maybe journeying with somebody going through the DR, you know, process?
The mistakes are typically which cause them to go in the DR process to begin with.
Sure.
At least partially, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, are we being Mr. Rogers with folks, or are we being judgmental and critical and harsh? But it's, you know, I get it. The reality is there's not a linear 7-step manual that has been handed to us from heaven that this is what we need to follow, exactly what it looks like for the grief or DR process. And so some people can, you know, push people where they're just not at, right? So acceptance, it's this dialectic of how can I provide this profound space where I can accept my brother and sister who's going through this?
Yeah.
How can I be wise in, maybe there are things that I could be helpful with, but it becomes more an invitation rather than a critical complaint. You know, it becomes, instead of, hey, this is what you need to do. Hey, John, would you mind if I share something with you? You know what? I'm not at a place where I feel comfortable with that. Or you've developed such a relationship with me that I welcome that. Talk to me.
Right.
Right. But so that takes a lot of intentionality. It takes a lot of grace and love and, well, it takes a lot of Jesus-y kind of stuff.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. So that's my encouragement for those who are walking alongside. And then read a book. Read something like my book, Religious Refugees, to get an inside scoop of what's really happening with loved ones.
Yeah.
Or Kathy Escobar's Faith Shift, you know, some kind of book that if you may not know and that person you see is struggling is not articulating what's going on with them, learn it like that. Take that missional mindset. You know, how can I enter into their world and being so sensitive to the nuances and complexity of their experience where I can bring love into that space, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really helpful. And I think important stuff. It reminds me of that sort of like weep with those who weep, you know, and rejoice with those who rejoice. Like, I think we're so hesitant to actually enter into other people's emotions for a myriad of reasons. A lot of times because we don't even know our own emotions or are scared of our own questioning, you know.
Things.
Yeah.
That's a huge part of it. I mean, I see this in all kinds of work, but to the degree that we're able to sit with our own fears,
right,
our own inner questioning, our own inner critic, our own shame, our own pain, our own trauma, sometimes is the degree that we can provide and hold that space for others. And this is a reason why some people, not all people, but some who can have such a visceral, hot-tempered reaction to somebody questioning theology.
Right.
Because these people have fused themselves where their identity is so intertwined with this belief that to hear someone else question it is then to question their whole identity, which brings up a lot of anxiety and fear that they don't want to sit with themselves. And so instead of listening, it's more of a reaction. And yeah, and then you're just dealing with people in your fight or flight threat system, as opposed to what neuroscience shows that we have another part, which is a caregiving system, a tend and befriend system.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how much fear plays into all that. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about fundamentalism, and I don't just mean even like conservative fundamentalism. I think there's a progressive fundamentalism. You know, I think we could be fundamentalist in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of that fundamentalism is fear-based, right? Of like anybody sort of questioning, you know, anything that we sort of hold to be true, and unwillingness to sort of like search those things out, you know?
Yeah, it's this fear. And there's another interesting thing that I've been thinking about. It's sort of this, there are some people, it's not out of fear. It's out of this firm, it's a lot of like out of this interesting sense of righteousness, you know? And this goes on to the fundamentalish attitudes that even some progressive, you know, quote, woke people can have, where it's like, I feel that I'm so right. It's not even out of fear. It's just out of this, maybe it's like a sense of pride or a sense of righteousness where I am so right that this is the Jesus way. Like even people who are hashtag woke, it saddens me. It's like, well, they're not Christian. Well, that's not a Jesus thing. Well, they believe in this policy. They're automatically not, well, they're not in a relationship with God.
Right.
And I'm thinking, gosh, that's exactly the mindset and attitude that you left the church because of.
Yes.
And so it's this interesting thing where Israel can be saved and set free, but then there's this internalized mimicry, if you will. This is post-colonial theory where we internalize some of these same processes and then we internalize and we become the oppressors. Mm-hmm. As we know, Israel wind up doing the very things that Egypt did, you know, genocide and the like. But I think sometimes those who are liberal, progressive, or even gone through the deconstruction, reconstruction process, I wish there was a little more of the same things that they craved through their own process, which was patience, love. Mm-hmm. And I'm all about, listen, it's okay to say, in my experience or in my opinion, we can have a prophetic flair that says that proposition, I feel, is not Jesus-like.
Right.
What happens is they wind up saying, instead of focusing on the proposition, they dehumanize the person. Mm. And for me, that's sort of an invitation. No, let's affirm the Imago Dei in that person as well. And at the same time, I do advocate the sense of, okay, we can speak truth to power, but let's not use our anger to destroy human beings, if you will.
Man,
policies, practices, systems, let's go for it.
Now, I think that's really important, Mark. I think that's a really good word. for all of us, you know, the Imago Dei, the, you know, how much God loves his people, you know, and I think that's an important part of all of this. So good. That's helpful stuff. Do you feel like we've kind of traversed the book like in good ways? Do you have something that you maybe we haven't gone over or? Yeah,
we traversed 5% of a 350 page book.
Right.
But right. Yeah, there's so much that could be talked about. You know, I don't know exactly where to go, but in the book, you know, I believe that deconstruction can be good. Mm-hmm. I do believe Jesus said, "You have heard it was said, but I tell you." And I spend much of the book in reconstruction.
Right.
Deconstruction without reconstruction is just destruction to me.
Right.
And God is a God of movement, of mission, of constant luring us in each moment, doing something special and beautiful and inspiring and challenging and comforting. And so reconstruction is just what God does.
Yeah.
And so I spend a lot of the book helping folks reconstruct their faith, as I very careful about being a God. I always share that this is my experience, because part of what got us here is us listening to those who are the omnipotent type of figures,
yeah,
where we were taking everything they were saying, hook, line, and sinker. But I encourage people to walk out their own journey. Mm. And this kind of, it reminds me of Bronnie Ware. And I talk about this, I think, in the last chapter, who was a palliative caregiver, working with people in the last, you know, days of their lives on their deathbed. She wrote the top 5 regrets of the dying. She said one of those regrets that she heard from those who were dying that I'll never forget, that I take to heart, is that they said, "I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me."
Wow.
"I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me." And remember, these are people, countless people on their deathbed. This is one of the top 5 regrets. "I don't want to live that way. I don't want others to live that way. There are so many people who love God and feel stifled because they feel like they're different. They might hold a different... they might look at certain theology in a different way. I just want to give people free rein in Christ, in community, to be who they are."
Yeah.
If you feel called to do a wacky, wild ministry, to love people in a very unique way, something that the four walls of the church would, you know, maybe frown upon, do. I mean, I remember people, you know, trying to minister to prostitutes, right? Or
right,
trying to minister to people sometimes in the bars, you know?
Yeah.
And like, "That's wrong. Jesus would never do that. You know, that's heretical.
Right.
You're going to fall." But those are just a few examples of just a myriad number of different ministries that people can have. And I just want people to be who they are in God. It's not some wild humanistic, you know, hey, live a life of pure satanic debauchery.
Right.
It's an invitation to be who God created you to be.
Yeah.
And I have this sense, and this is from research, that people, I don't want people to suffer for the rest of their lives fearing what people think about them.
Right.
It's a brutal way to live. Now, if I may share, once again, my lens of compassion, I fully get it, because we are tribal creatures. We used to live in tribes, if you will, and to stray from the tribe's rituals or beliefs literally would be a death sentence, right?
Right.
Either it would bring harm to the tribe, or it would, you know, bring harm to ourselves, because the tribe would say, "If you believe that or if you do that, we're going to kick you out," which ultimately led to your death. But we still have that brain.
Right.
And that's why rejection from the church, from our nervous systems, feels like a threat. Mm. It feels like almost like a death sentence for the church to ostracize us, or, man, if they found out, they call me a heretic. That psychic pain, if you will, that emotional pain is so intense. It's wired into our nervous systems. It makes a lot of sense. And so I have a lot of compassion for those. Plus, when you then experience the church and you say, well, the church is linked with God.
Right.
Now, God is on the church's side and they're both saying you're a heretic. My goodness, who wouldn't want to conform?
Right. Yeah.
Who would want to leave that? That's scary.
Yeah, for sure. That's good.
Yeah. So there's a few other things. And in the book, I talk about self-compassion and forgiveness and living a life according to values and all kinds of really cool stuff.
Yeah. That's great. I love it. Where can people kind of find you? What's the best places to, you know, check out the book and all that stuff?
I would say most certainly Amazon, but Facebook is probably the best thing. Okay. I know I'm old school. I'm a dinosaur at this point. There is a site that I invite people to go to too, and that's conspiringprayer.com. That delves into a little bit of, I do talk about this in the new book, but a little bit in the new book, I talk about theodicy. And that is those who are deconstructing and reconstructing our faith. How do we make sense of evil?
Yeah.
How do we make sense of where was God when I was believing this stuff that I now consider toxic? What was God doing?
Right.
So getting into trust, what's up with petitionary prayer? Does that work? Is it effective? Does it matter? And so with that site, you'll find a lot of stuff on petitionary prayer more specifically. And so, yeah. So Facebook, conspiringprayer.com and markgregorykaris.com. That's my therapist website.
I love it. I appreciate it, man. It's good stuff. Well, are you ready to jump into the final two questions?
Oh, please.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
I don't know. I mean, on the list of strange jobs, I don't know this would, for some reason, the deli, I worked at a deli.
Sure.
It was such a wild atmosphere. And I do remember that blade cutting my finger and going to the hospital several times, cutting the meats.
Yeah, sure.
You know, on that thing. Not too strange, but it's probably, yeah. I mean, I was in construction a little bit and worked in a nursing home for a while. But yeah, those are, you know, probably the strangest, but not too strange on the spectrum.
I feel like anytime you're dealing with the public, though, it's going to get weird, right? I mean, just people are strange in general.
So. Yeah. And the workers there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah,
for sure.
Good. All right. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Jesus said, I only do what I see my Father doing. If we took the beautifully dangerous risk of saying, God, I'm here at my job and I'm looking around and I'm saying, God, I want to do what you're doing, right? I want to be your hands and feet here in this workplace, in this day. And I'm a firm believer that if we listen to the Spirit, and we take time to silence and center ourselves. My goodness. The thing is, though, that's scary as all heck. Because there's a requirement there. Yeah. It's like, are you sure?
Right.
And I've been there. I've been, hey, God, I'm at the mall. I want to do what you're doing here. Help me. I want to be your hands and feet. Mark, I want you to go over to that psychic, and I want you to tell her about Jesus. Mm. And I remember, of course, being scared. And I remember going over to her and she read palms. And I said, would you mind if I read your palm? And I said, this line means that Jesus loves you. And this line means that he has a plan and purpose for your life. But my goodness, those spirit-led, spirit-empowered encounters. So that, what's my advice? To listen and to lead in love.
Mm.
And just those things, man, that is some dangerous stuff right there. So, I mean, it could be a word of encouragement. It could, you know, buy somebody a water, you know, it uplift, empower, encourage, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Give someone a ride home if their car. There's so many things if we just open our heart, open our mind, and it's really interesting what can happen.
That's awesome. I appreciate that. That's great stuff, Mark. I've really enjoyed getting to chat a little bit and appreciate the work and all you got going on, man.
I appreciate talking with you. It's been a real blessing. Thanks, brother. So thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Mark. And I just, like he said in the interview, if you're going through a process like this, there are resources out there and you're not alone. And there are people to walk alongside you, even if it feels lonely. So I encourage you to check out those resources. Reach out to your church community if there still is one there. Maybe a safe people, or, you know, always reach out to me. Happy to chat. So, yeah, but I hope you got a lot out of this interview. Maybe this like sparked something that you hadn't thought of before. I encourage you to check out Mark's book and what he has going on. This is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app, and you can leave a rating and review there, which just really helps get the word out about the podcast. It's super helpful for me. I really appreciate it. It's nice to know that y'all are listening and enjoying, honestly. So I encourage you to do that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.